Last Sunday morning we began a new series in the Book of Esther. We were in the city of Shushan in the Empire of Persia in the days when it was the world superpower of the time. And we were considering some of the actions of this king whose name mystifies us, King Ahasuerus, or King Xerxes, who reigned from 485 to about 464 BC. In last week's study, we observed that this man was great in power. He reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia, a vast array of countries that he was the sovereign over. We observe too that he had immense wealth, that he could afford to throw a party for the leaders of those differing provinces and for the generals in his army that lasted for 180 days. We saw too that this king was great in his pride. He was a pompous king. He thought he had it all. He had the greatest nation in the world and he sat on its throne. He had such incredible wealth that he could throw these lavish parties where the utensils that were used were made of solid gold and each one was different from another. He had the most beautiful woman in the land as his wife. And he wanted to show off all of these things. His great nation, his powerful army, his gold cups and saucers, and his beautiful wife. But we saw that his beautiful wife had a pride of her own and wasn't going to be treated like a cup or saucer, even a gold cup or saucer. And she refused to come into his drunken party. She must have known what she was doing. She must have had some idea of the incredible power of this king. She must have realized that in making this refusal, her own life may be put on the line. And yet she stood firm, and in consequence of which, the king was thrown into a rage. And the men who stood around him, his princes, his advisers, were filled with paranoia. If the queen will do this, then every other woman in the land will do this. No husband will get any meals made for him anymore. The washing will never get done. We must stamp out any idea that a woman has a mind of her own. Well, that's the general idea you get, isn't it? From reading what these men had to say. And so the king, in his rage and fury and in his inebriation, listened to their advice, passed a law that said that every woman needed to obey her husband. And also, in the process, got rid of Vashti, got rid of his beautiful wife, who had a mind of her own. What happened next? Well, Esther, the book of Esther, doesn't actually tell us. But between Esther chapter 1 and verse 3, where it tells us that in the third year of his reign he threw this lavish party, and towards the end of Esther chapter 2, where we're told that these things took place in the seventh year of his reign. 4 years have passed. One of those years has been taken up with these beauty preparations for all these other women who didn't quite reach Vashti's level of beauty. What about the other 3 years? Between Esther chapter 1 and verse 22 and Esther chapter 2 and verse 1, King Ahasuerus has been a very busy man. He's been at war. And he chose as his enemies the Greeks. Not a very wise thing to do. And after 3 years of war, Ahasuerus returned to Shushan with the proverbial tail between his legs. He's been defeated. He's still got a vast empire, to be sure. But the Greeks had humiliated him and were on the road eventually to becoming the next world superpower. And so, under these circumstances, Ahasuerus, sitting in his palace in Shushan, is pondering these past years, meditating on his defeats. And another defeat comes to mind. We're told in verse 1 that he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. And you kind of get the feeling, as the writer has presented this story to us, that he's not feeling particularly good about that decision either. It's interesting that the Hebrew text tells us that he remembered what had been decreed against her, not, as some translations say, what he had done to her. That's interesting because, as so often in politics, he's shifting the blame. After all, it wasn't his idea. He's just an innocent victim in all of this. His advisors should have known better. They should have directed him more carefully. But according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, this decision cannot be revoked. It's on the statute book. Vashti shall no longer be queen. And no doubt, these thoughts running through this king's mind add to his misery. And his servants look on. What's going to happen now? Is he going to blame us? Are we going to lose our position? So the king's servants who attended him said, "We've got an idea, Your Highness. Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint officers in all 127 provinces. Let them look out for the most beautiful women. Bring them into Shushan, the citadel. Let preparations be made. Let them for 12 months be beautified. And then the young woman who pleases the king, she shall be queen instead of Vashti." And maybe they were thinking secretly, though they don't say it, all beauty and no brain, that's the kind of queen we need for King Ahasuerus. Not a queen who's got a mind of her own, who's going to think independent thoughts. A beautiful queen that the king can show off without fear of being humiliated again. And so things proceed. The king likes the idea. And so the decree goes out through all 127 provinces. And then the writer stops and he pauses and he tells us another story. He tells us about a man, a Jew to be precise. His name is Mordecai. And he takes us back 100 years or so, from about 480, 479 BC, back to 586 BC. and the days of the great King Nebuchadnezzar, another powerful, proud, mighty king. That king had overrun Judah, had destroyed Jerusalem, and had brought a vast number of Jews into captivity in Babylon. King Ahasuerus, king of Persia, had inherited the descendants of that captivity. As the Persians had overrun Babylon and become the next superpower, so the people who had been captured became their prisoners. And we're told that this Mordecai, he was a descendant of a man, Kish, who had been carried away from Jerusalem along with the king Jeconiah of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away into captivity. Kish had a son, Shimei, who had a son, Jair, who had a son, Mordecai. And this man, Mordecai, he's going to feature in this story. So here he is, he's introduced. Mordecai himself had an interesting history, brought up there in Babylon, presumably, now living in Persia. He had a cousin whose parents had died, presumably fairly early on in her life, and he had taken her as his own daughter and had raised her up. And now she's a beautiful young woman. And so when this decree goes out from the king, and it's heard throughout all these 127 provinces, Mordecai hears about this decree as well. And the men appointed in the province where he lives, if he's in Shushan or somewhere else, they are observing, they're looking out. Who are the beautiful virgins in this town, in this city, in this province? And so Esther, a beautiful young woman, is taken, gathered to Shushan, the citadel. She's one of these beautiful young women whom the king is going to look at. It seems that there was no choice involved here. We're told in verse 8, when the king's command and decree were heard, and when the young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace. If you're familiar with the book of Esther, if you know anything about Mordecai, you can hardly believe that he had encouraged her to go along into that situation. But there she was, under a command, a decree, the authority of the king, and taken there into Shushan. Now this young woman is beautiful to behold, but as we read through this chapter, we realise something else about her. She's obviously got a very captivating personality as well. The young woman pleased Haggai, the custodian of the women in the king's palace. She obtained his favour. He readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. He gave her 7 choice maidservants, provided from the king's palace, women who would know the king's expectations, know how the palace functioned. She was given every advantage that Haggai could conceive of, because he'd taken a liking to her. Now, I've no doubt that your experience is a bit like my experience, and I'm sure Haggai's was somewhat similar. But beautiful women are not always nice. But here was one that was. Here was one that Haggai was willing to bend over backwards to help. She wasn't just beautiful to see. He was used to seeing beautiful women. He looked after the king's harem. This was his job. No, there was more than beauty of body that Haggai saw. He saw a woman who was beauty in spirit as well. And so he helped her and provided all that she needed. He was her advisor. She had been brought up by Mordecai to understand what authority was and what obedience to authority was. She knew the benefits of seeking advice, of going to those who were in the know. And so when eventually it became her turn to go in to the palace to meet the king, when she was told she can take anything you like, the best outfit, the most expensive jewelry, you can do your makeup, whatever you like, it's yours. And Esther, we're told, only took with her what Haggai advised her. He would know what would please the king. He would know what was appropriate. When her turn came, in she went. Esther was taken to the king, verse 16, into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And we're told the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther. This is the end of the story, we think. But then we're told, when the virgins were gathered together a second time, we don't know why, we don't know when, sometime after this, after Esther's been made queen, Mordecai comes into the story once more. Mordecai now sits within the king's gate. When I was a kid, I used to think that this meant that he was a beggar. You know the story in the parables of the beggar who sits at the gate of the rich man, begging? And that's the picture I had of someone who was at the gate. But that's not what it means. If you know the story of Ruth, you'll know that Boaz was a man who was known at the gate. He was a respected citizen. He took his seat with the elders. If you know the book of Proverbs and those last verses there which speak about the virtuous wife, we're told that her husband also was a man who was familiar with the gates of the city. Not because he walked in and out of them, but because he sat in them. It was the place where justice was seen to be done. It was the place where the respected men gathered and gave their judgment, where legal decisions were made, where people were tried, where advice was given, where vows were witnessed. And we find that by this time, that's where Mordecai is. Perhaps it's through Esther's influence that he's gained his seat there. Perhaps he already was there. Perhaps that's how Esther was known to the people who were looking for beautiful women. They'd seen her around Mordecai in the king's gate. We don't know. What we do know is that Mordecai at this time was there in the king's gate, and it was significant. Mordecai, sitting there, overhears something, or in some other way finds out about a conspiracy, about a plot. Two of the king's eunuchs somehow, for some reason, have become enraged, and Bigthan and Teresh are plotting to seize the king, to assassinate him. This wasn't an uncommon thing, and in fact this very king sometime later would be assassinated. No wonder he had that close following, as we saw last week, of a few men who had access into his presence. The general public didn't normally see the king of Persia. His life was too valuable. And here these furious men are plotting his downfall. But Mordecai, he hears about it. And Mordecai, though he's a Jew, and one could argue that he should have every reason to not be particularly happy with a vulgar, proud drunkard of a king like this, was nevertheless faithful to the king. And he spoke to Esther, made known to her this plot against the king's life. Esther then informs the king, inquiries are made, the plot is confirmed, the villains are executed. Well, it's an exciting story, isn't it? Full of intrigue and beauty pageants and everything else you could wish for. But so what? What's the point of it all? Well, what are we to learn from a chapter like this? Well, let me first of all say that it's sometimes difficult and sometimes inappropriate to wrench a chapter like this out of its full context. This isn't the end of the story. We're only on chapter 2. There are 10 chapters. The story isn't over yet. But let me draw out just a couple of lessons from this. You know how our lives can be so mundane. You know, we just live our lives. There are decisions that have to be made, choices we have to make, where we live, what job we're going to do, who we'll marry, where we'll send our kids to school, what we're going to do with our investments. All of those sorts of decisions, we're making them every day, aren't we? Some are much more major than others, but constantly through our lives, every day of our lives, we just go on living, making decisions, reacting to what happens around us and what comes into our lives. The redundancy, the cancer, the problems with the kids, all of these things. And sometimes we can think that life is so mundane and the tasks are so irksome. And where are we going? And what's happening to us? What's going on in it all? And one of the lessons that a chapter like this teaches us is that God is always in control. And God is always working out his purposes in our lives. God is never mentioned in this book of Esther by name. Never once. And yet through its pages we constantly see the evidence of him being at work. A king of Persia, for example, normally would have taken a wife from among the noble families, from among the princes of Persia. It was very, very unusual for a king of Persia to find a wife somewhere else. This king chooses to do it by a beauty pageant of all things. I mean, he could get anyone. He might get someone that's just been taken off the street just because she looked beautiful. No royal blood flowing through her veins. No aristocratic background. No relatives of influence. But he's willing to do it. That's an amazing thing in and of itself in this story. There's Esther. An orphan. Who knows what might have happened to her? But in God's providence, Mordecai, her cousin, takes her into his family, raises her as his own daughter, teaches her important values and priorities in life. God has given her, blessed her with great beauty of body and of personality. Everyone around her likes her. She's taken in among what one of the contemporary historians of that time said were about 400 virgins gathered there in Shushan. She's just one out of all those 400. And yet, she's the one that Haggai favours and promotes. She's the one who finds favour in the eyes of all those around her. And she's the one who eventually finds favour in the eyes of the king. Those events, they're just going through their normal lives. Yes, some unusual circumstances have certainly come into their lives. But Esther goes along to Shushan, not because she's chosen to, not because she knows that there's some great destiny for her, other than to be queen of Persia. She goes along because she has to. There's a decree, there's a command. She has no choice. She goes along. Mordecai hangs around. He's concerned. He wants to make sure that she's doing okay. He becomes known. She helps him, perhaps. He finds a seat in the king's gate. He becomes a man of influence. And in God's providence, he hears about a plot against the king, which is going to be of utmost importance in the future. But he doesn't know that. And Esther doesn't know that. And Haggai doesn't know that. And the king doesn't know any of these things. They're just going on through their lives. And who knows what thing of vast importance, of eternal significance, may depend upon the things that are going on in your life right now. We none of us know. You've all heard, I expect, of C.H. Spurgeon, Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the prince of preachers of the 19th century. One snowy winter's night, as a 15-year-old, he's walking to his normal church, and the wind is blowing and the snow is falling. So he goes to a different church, sees one up an alleyway, and there he goes. And he sits down, and there's a few other people there. And they wait and they wait and they wait, and the preacher doesn't show up. So an old man hobbles forward and climbs into that pulpit of that church. And he proceeds to give a word. Little did that man know that through preaching on that day, God would bring to salvation a man who would be used to save millions of souls. We don't know his name. We only know of that tiny segment of his life. That decision. No one else here willing to do it. He would try. He would give them something to take away. We don't know what God's providences are until after they've taken place. And God is working out all of these things for the church. For a bigger picture than my own life and your own life. Sometimes, we could say often, bad things happen to good people. And we always wish and hope and pray that there'll be a happy ending to it all. In the bigger scheme of things, there will be. But in the terms of a lifespan, there may not be. The person who has experienced those bad things in their life may never see the ultimate good that they result in. I don't imagine that for Esther, a faithful Jew, life in the palace, in the harem of the most powerful man on earth, was particularly nice. I imagine that she would have actually preferred to have stayed in the home of Mordecai, if the choice had been hers. But as we'll see as we go through this series, great things were to come of the bad situation she finds herself in. God is working, was working in her life, in those events of chapter 2, for the good that could be done in later chapters of this story. God is working in your life today to solve problems of tomorrow. He sees the beginning from the end. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he has the king's heart in his hand, and he is the one who directs its course. So the great lesson here is trust in the Lord. Trust in his ways, in his will, even when it's a puzzle to you and you've no idea what today's events are meaning, what their significance is. Trust the Lord that he's working out his purposes for your good and the good of the church. Well, may the Lord help us to do that for his glory. Amen.